Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
SohoNet, the world's expert in connectivity for the entertainment industry. The SohoNet service and unrivaled support provide seamless collaboration on a global scale between studios and facilities, whatever their size, wherever they are in the world.
Thanks for joining us for this FX podcast. I'm Jeff Huser, and I'm joined on the line for this special podcast with Mike Seymour and John Montgomery.
I've got to say, it's amazing. It's our 200th episode. That's pretty unfucking believable.
Yes, it's quite a lot. I mean, obviously, the site's been going longer than the podcast, but of all the podcasts we do, and we now do about four or five of them, this has been going the longest. And I've got to say, I'm kind of fond of it.
I am quite proud of this. I mean, 200 episodes is a long run for any type of ongoing thing in this industry, and it's been such a blast and a great time over the years doing these.
And I think it's still accomplishing. My thing about the podcast was always that feeling that you could hear directly from the person we're talking to, the passion, the emotion, the feelings, in way more detail than you can by writing down what they said. And I still love that part of listening to the podcasts, all the podcasts we do, but in particular this one, talking to the filmmakers most often, getting to hear them talk about techniques and, you know, things that would be very difficult to even work into an article.
Well, I think the other thing is we always built FX Guide and then FX PhD on a sense of community. And I think, as you say, hearing people from people directly builds that sense of community because, you know, as we've seen over time and certainly will, you know, continue to see, people start out, you know, as somebody that's like an artist and then they become a comp supervisor and then they become a lead and then they become a, you know, supervisor and, you know, in a major film. And it's just that sort of progression that, you know, I think it's great.
And I love the kind of detail and in-depth stuff that comes out in our podcasts, you know, not dumbing them down. I mean, I got to say, I was telling Mike earlier that I was over at Leviathan here in Chicago and introducing ourselves. We want to do some stories and go, you know, you go and introduce it. We're FX Guide and ran into Matt Daly there who just came up to me and said, you know what, I really love what you guys are doing. I just can't find that kind of detail direct from the people type podcast, direct from the artists and the craftsmen about it. And, you know, he's basically just like us, right? They're doing some great graphics work over there, leading some great projects. And I really love hearing stories like that from him, kind of that we are on the right track in what we're doing with the FX podcast.
I was just going to say, we started the site kind of with the mantra that, well, this interests all three of us. It must interest more people. And the podcast kind of is the same cloth, you know. We've kind of always pursued things that interested us and questions that we had and were curious about, and meeting people that we wanted to meet and talk to. So I think that's been a great part of it.
Yeah, I think one of the things, I mean, obviously it's easy to get attracted by the big shiny thing, which is normally the big feature film. It has obviously a ton of visual effects and normally a lot of new tech and stuff, and we have done our fair share of those over the years, and I make no apologies for them. But I also think the other nice thing is that if you look at what we've done in the FX podcast over the years, we've actually tackled some fairly, you know, interesting side issues. So it hasn't all just been, you know, the big sort of features. There's quite a lot of really left field things in there. And sometimes those are the ones that resonate with a lot of people because they're just simply not being discussed anywhere else.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. And again, I think it's been a great run, a great mix. And Jeff, you're totally right about, you know, the people that we run into, listen to it, are frankly people that are, you know, very much like us who care about the business and the craft and earn it for, you know, the reasons we all are. So it's been a fun road. And I never would have thought that, I definitely know where I was when we started these. And I was in Durango, Colorado. I had actually just left or was going to quit at the time. And I remember Mike did an audio interview, and I'm like, well, I've been hearing about this podcast thing, and iTunes is coming out, and I think maybe we should try and formalize it so it automatically downloads in iTunes and stuff. And it was kind of a nice timing on the part of technology and some of the ideas that we had going on FX Guide, especially now when you consider all the different media stuff that we do on the site.
And I think we should also point out that, you know, today we're recording this after hearing of the passing of Steve Jobs, and it's no accident that there's pretty much an iPhone logo in the middle of our FX Guide FX podcast. So there used to be an iPod graphically represented in the middle of our FX Guide FX podcast. And this is, after all, a podcast.
Very much, very true.
Yeah. I mean, really, you know, one of those classic cases of taking some technology from somebody that, you know, really provided a way for us to do stuff we weren't able to do before and then run with it. I mean, this has been an awesome experience, but I do personally feel like we owe a debt of gratitude to Apple. And now I think today in particular is a good time to just, you know, acknowledge that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. Without the Pod and FX podcast, I'm not sure we'd be doing all the stuff that we're doing nowadays and making it so easy for people to get at and share and listen to wherever they are, you know, the stories of people listening on the train, the car, the plane, whatever it is, you know, has a large part to do with some of the technology that was part of his brainchild. So definitely filled with sadness and he'll be missed.
Well, and frankly, both sites, FX Guide and FX PhD, pretty much are poster children for the Made on the Mac banner. Almost everything we do goes through, you know, Macintosh software. We always make sure we're compatible with all the latest, you know, iPad, iPhone, everything. It's we're very, you know, responsive to that market because we know so many of our people are Mac people and we're very much Mac people.
And I think you should also point out that we're not just Mac focused, because obviously if you just look at the new lineup at FX PhD this term, like obviously we're not like a Mac centric facility, as it were. You know, there's obviously a lot of stuff that we do. I just feel really, it's a pretty significant day all around.
Agreed.
It certainly is. But I am glad you brought up PhD because we just announced the term last Friday. And I think we've got a great lineup of new courses. I just scrambled home in time to record this because I was recording stuff for the O Week video with Craig Leffel here in Chicago, who's in a who I personally feel is the top colorist in town, and he's leading a craft of color grading course that we've got going. I'm really excited about starting out. That I'm serving as kind of what the tour guide, I guess you could say, leading along in that course. But I think that's going to be a lot of fun. One of my favorites for the term that we've got.
Yeah, I think the two things that enable us to do the work that we do is obviously FX PhD, which is tremendously the sort of backbone of the company, if you want to call it that, and then the other thing, of course, is we've got a lot of support from people on FX Insider on the FX Guide site. So if you're listening to this, I'd encourage you to basically check out both of those things. You can either support us through FX Insider, which we'll say thank you for, and actually even give you some bonus stories and stuff each week or so, and that's obviously on the homepage of FX Guide. We've had a lot of people that have done that already. So for those of you that are already signed up with Insider and are supporting us, thank you. And of course, all of you that are also members of FX PhD do a tremendous job in supporting us. And quite frankly, we just couldn't do this without you guys. And hopefully, yeah, as John said, you'll find the new October term kind of as interesting as we have.
Yeah, it really has been a lot of fun. I mean, all this stuff has been fun, and kind of resounding community, meeting people around the world. It's been fantastic, and I think that's one of the things about our industry is it really has become a global industry. And I remember listening to going back to my Durango, Colorado story. I remember laying on my back in a pool with my iPod Shuffle wrapped in plastic wrap so it wouldn't get wet. Listening to Mike, the interview that you had done with Paul Franklin, one of our very early FX podcasts. Just thinking at that time, you know what? We might be onto something with this.
Yes, and in a minute, we'll listen to our 200th episode, which is in fact features, amongst others, Paul Franklin. In fact, it features four of the top facilities in London, which is MPC, CineSite, Framestore, and Double Negative. And we're very proud of this episode because we reached out to them with some help from our sponsors this week, which is SohoNet. And we said, look, we really want to do something special for this 200th ep. And there were a few places we could have gone and a few ways we could have gone. But for me, this was one that really personally interests me a lot. And I've got to say, it was kind of a bit humbling, the instant and overwhelming response we got from those four facilities to contribute. Because as you said, you know, a lot of them listen to the stuff and read stuff on FX Guide and, you know, big supporters of the site.
Yeah, it really is. And I like this, I like the, you know, the podcast, because I think in many ways it, the timetable kind of compares somewhat with the timetable of the FX podcast we first started doing. It's a little longer process, I think, than that. And so I think it's really especially appropriate for our 200th episode. Still can't believe it, 200th episode to have that.
Well, especially as you look back over the 200 episodes, there's been quite a bunch of, quite a bit of change in the business. And certainly the London market has been one of those that's kind of, you know, taken a very prominent role in the visual effects community during that time period, really. And I think it's interesting to look at it from that standpoint and really looking at kind of the podcasts leading up to this as kind of a time capsule in a lot of ways.
Well, yeah, that's for sure. Well, why don't we go ahead and we'll come back after the podcast to chat a bit more. But why don't we go ahead and cross to that? This is our 200th FX podcast episode at FX Guide. So let's go ahead and go to that now. And before we go to that, I just want to also thank Matt Graham, who did a really fantastic job helping edit this and put it together.
I think London is now seen as a centre of excellence and of quality, and also it has the capacity to deliver large films.
There are days when I just get sort of chills watching it. I just think, wow, man, there are just some amazing people here doing some stuff. Like, how the hell do they do that?
The collaborative effort happens in the execution of the work. We do kill one another in competition to secure it in the first place.
I think ultimately it's a true global industry now, and where everything was about everything in Hollywood, it's not now. It's where can you have a facility that's got good infrastructure, got good track record, and equally where there's a healthy, trained body of staff, and you can get encouraged and tax relief.
I know of other companies who, even in the same time zone, are struggling to have more than one site because it's not trivial.
I think the biggest challenge is always finding enough qualified and talented staff.
So in pre-production meetings 10 years ago, you didn't necessarily always have a visual effects person. We were quite often seen as more junior people.
The single hardest factor at the moment for everything is time.
But equally, you know, they want the quality, and currently it's the best and cheapest place in the world to make a movie. That's without a shadow of a doubt.
For this, our 200th episode of FX Podcast, we wanted to look at some of the big changes that had happened over the last 10 years. And there are many ways that you could look at this, but one of the most interesting ones for us has been the growth of what we like to call the UK houses. Because over the last 10 years in particular, there's been a massive amount of growth in what's been happening in visual effects in the London market. Now, there's been a lot of other stories that we could have looked at, but in just the 2 years in the middle of that sector between 2006 and 2008, the revenues in the UK companies grew by some astonishing 17% and their workforce by a similar amount. In any one year, you're seeing growth on growth out of the UK houses that leads basically to having an industry in the UK that you would want to have included on any roster of companies quoting for any major effects film in the world. So here we have the situation that you have four companies, Double Negative, Framestore, CineSite, and MPC, which had have to be on your roster for considering for any Hollywood blockbuster or any international blockbuster for that matter, yet they're all within 10 minutes walk of each other in Soho. And the question we had is, why is that the case? What has caused these four houses to grow so dramatically? And are they, in fact, still London or even European facilities, or are they now global conglomerates? And to help us with that, we thought we'd sit down and talk to four key individuals from both the management and the visual effects supervision side of the industry at each of the four major houses. Paul Franklin is one of the key members of Double Negative, or DNEG, which is a film-only effects house with now, of course, offices around the world. The company was actually set up in 1998 with a team of about 30 staff, and it's grown to have over 1,000, making it one of Europe's largest providers of visual effects for films. Now, this is, unlike some of the other companies, a privately owned company, of course, very, very successful with huge film credits, including Inception, the Batman films. In fact, in last year's Oscars, three of the films that were nominated had effects from DNEG. That would be Inception, Iron Man 2, and Harry Potter, The Deathly Hallows Part 1, with, of course, Inception going on to win and Paul Franklin getting an Oscar. So Paul is currently actually on the set of the latest Batman film with the same director for Christopher Nolan. This is The Dark Knight Rises. And he joins me by phone from there after a very long day of shooting, which is really kind of him. I just want to say before I cross to Paul that he's actually one of the first interviews we ever did here on the FX podcast. He's been a really huge friend to FX Guide and made a it's been a real joy talking to him over the years, especially as we watch the company grow in such enormous size and stature.
It's certainly a double negative. We always saw our competition in the early days as being coming from the West Coast of the United States. You know, we aspired to be able to go head to head with the likes of ILM, Digital Domain, and all the other companies. I mean, who wouldn't? You know, that's what you want to do. You want to make the best visual effects work on the best films. That's what those guys were doing and still are doing. It's now become this this international competition, and I think that's a good thing because it's constantly pushing us. Obviously, on the price, which is an important thing to the end client, and that's the nature of competition. It gets you the best price for the work you're wanting to do, but it also pushes us technically and creatively. You know, I look at the work that some of our competitors around the world do, and I think, oh my goodness, you know, I've really got to pull my socks up. I've got to try and be able to do something as good as that next time round, and. You know, just when you think you've done something really cool, you know, you can't rest on your laurels because, you know, an Avatar comes along or, you know, I was pretty particularly impressed by The Rise of the Apes recently. And, you know, that I thought, well, that's, you know, that set a new standard there that the rest of us are all going to have to catch up with. And, you know, somebody will surpass that standard and then those guys will come back and we'll keep on going on. Because it is still this extraordinary marriage of science and art. You know, I come from very much a fine arts background, but my family are very much a science-based family. So I think that helped me. But, you know, I see people from technical backgrounds who want to get into what we do, and they don't know how to get into the whole creative side of things. You know, how do they start? Where do they go? Where do they learn about stuff that's relevant to what we're doing? Likewise, I meet creative artists who come from very traditional media who want to work with our tools, but they're bewildered and alienated by the tool sets because they find them to be extremely awkward when compared to just drawing with a pencil and paper or painting with oils on canvas.
Anthony Hunt is the managing director of CineSight, which is actually part of Kodak. CineSight set up offices in Hollywood in about 91, and then they opened in London in about 94. And these were basically, I guess you'd think of them almost as test sites for Kodak Cineon computer system. But CineSight, while starting in LA, obviously has ended up with London as the primary base, and that makes it one of the largest companies of its type in Europe. But it's a wholly owned subsidiary of Kodak. Of course, as I said, Anthony's now the managing director of CineSight, having joined CineSight Europe in about 2003. But he's worked on heaps of feature films, including tons of stuff like Gladiator, which of course went on to win the Oscar, but Golden Compass, which also went on to win Oscar and BAFTA. He's also the former managing director of Mill Film, which is really interesting. And also, if you go back further, he's the managing director, one of the co-founders of the Magic Camera Company, which, as you'll hear, is a really key player in the history of the English film market. And therefore, Anthony has a huge wealth of expertise in managing and strategy, as well as hands-on visual effects from all corners of the industry.
CineSight, yeah, it's obviously it was originally set up for Eastman Kodak to move into the digital technology back in, you know, the early 90s, predominantly in Los Angeles, and then it expanded out to London, which obviously is the main facility now. The Los Angeles business was closed back in 2003. But basically, the company has grown in London over that period of time since 1993. Predominantly started off as a scanning and recording facility, bureau service. DI was starting, you know, it's fairly in its infancy, certainly in the UK. And obviously, digital technology was still fairly in its infancy in the UK. There was only literally a couple of companies that moved into this territory. CineSight being one of them as a dedicated film company, visual effect film company at that time. And equally, in the early 90s, that's when the big transition was going from analog to digital and also from optical to digital visual effect as well. So there was quite a shift that took place during that period of time. And then, you know, a couple of big projects came along in the UK. It's a competitive environment globally now. And, you know, companies in Australia and Canada and India and Europe and America, of course, are equally hungry to survive and stay in business. And, you know, it's tough times, and it's all about, you know, continually to push the boundaries of the technology to try and find and attract great scripts that, you know, people, the studios will pay the right price for to produce, you know, some fantastic visual effect images. But I think also it's trying to keep a sensible control on costs. I mean, that's always a challenge. Equally, sometimes on a big blockbuster, they will want it in and out within probably, you know, 20 weeks sometimes, and it's maybe less, 15 or 12 weeks. And it's the bigger companies that have got the bandwidth and the headcount to be able to accommodate that. And that's a continual challenge for the future, is trying to have, you know, not necessarily just one big blockbuster in your operation at one time, because, you know, you as soon as that movie's finished, you know, you've got to find employment for all your staff for the next one. It's always trying to dovetail the jobs in sympathetically with the right skills.
MPC, or Motion Picture Company, as I knew it when I used to go there and grade stuff, is obviously a London house, but also it's California, Vancouver, Bangalore, New York, and all of those locations are fully networked together so their artists can share stuff, which makes it sort of very different from perhaps the others. Well, it's part of what we think of as this amazing internationalization that's come out of the London facilities. It's actually part of the Technicolor Group, and Technicolor itself has revenues of $1,074 million last quarter alone. That's about $4.5 billion in yearly revenues. And it's just a powerhouse of a company. And just in terms of patents, for example, it's had about 10,000 patents awarded to it since 2005, and I think it has about 42,000 patents in total. And when we say it's big, and we talk about these outlying offices, it's important to note that they're not just isolated kind of factories for doing, you know, small bits of stuff that they would outsource. The Bangalore Animation Facility, for example, has 900 staff in a 145,000 square foot facility. So they're really a major force to be reckoned with. And this internationalization is a really important part of them feeling like a really cohesive group, as we'll hear when we speak to Adam Valdez, who's a very successful VFX supervisor. Now, Adam's joining us to give a perspective really from an artist's point of view, and he's just a really honest and knowledgeable guy. His credits include films such as The Chronicles of Narnia, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. But prior to joining MPC, because he's been there for about 8 years, he worked at Weta on the Lord of the Rings films. He also worked on Starship Troopers and Dragonheart. Just a really, really insightful and, as I say, very honest and genuine guy.
I've been at MPC for 8 years because I really like the people I work with, and I think we've taken time to not just kind of obsess about photorealism or obsess about the latest SIGGRAPH paper, but we really invest on the filmmaker experience, and we have this basic saying that we make scenes, not shots, which is just a basic philosophy of how we want our effects, no matter how outlandish or fantastical, to fit into the movie. You know, we're always trying our best to do that. In that regard, our craft all around the world, everybody is doing amazing stuff and really, yeah, knocking it out of the park, and just almost to its own detriment, because people have grown so accustomed to this stuff, it's almost not special anymore. Because when I started doing this stuff, it was a struggle just to get anything done. And now I just look at the amount of work our group does in a given week, and we're always sort of looking at each other's stuff, and every week we kind of get a big report showing what everybody's been doing, and kind of look at each other's work in monthlies every month. And there are days when I just get sort of chills watching it. I just think, wow, man, there are just some amazing people here doing some stuff. Like, how the hell do they do that? I mean, I'm from California, and I've been doing this for, say, something like 22 or 23 years, and I've been in London for the last almost 8 of those years now, so I guess about a third of my career. And it is really different in London. It was born of a different industry. I mean, obviously, film in England has been around for a long time and has a great history, but the visual effects groups here are more born out of university students and post-production houses from TV. And it is a different culture in many ways within the companies here, and a lot of things, how people are recruited, how people think about their relationship to the studios and everything. It's just a different artist culture for sure. So I think that's changed a bit over the last 7 years, but it remains different to California, where I spent a fair amount of time. And, well, I've one experience at Weta for 4 years on Lord of the Rings. I haven't worked in Australia, but, you know, I think London is different.
Well, William Sargent, or Sir William Sargent, is one of the co-founders of Framestore from 1986. He founded it with Sharon Reed and Jonathan Hills and Mike McNee and Alison Turner. And this was basically one of the first places to really try and grapple with computers, as you'll hear we discussing when we joke about or discuss the name and the origins of the company. But in 1994, it set up a film effects division. Along the way, it acquired the Computer Film Company, or CFC, and that was in about 1997. And CFC had a really pivotal role in the English industry as well. But interestingly, Sir William went on to do stuff outside of just visual effects or our industry. And in fact, he was a British permanent secretary. I mean, he was like the first British permanent secretary to ever win an Oscar when Framestore was awarded the Academy Award for its work in 2008 on The Golden Compass. And Sir William's other, perhaps less glamorous title was the executive chairman of the Better Regulatory Executive. Now, this may sound like a kind of a, I don't know, slightly odd title and may mislead you into thinking it wasn't a really key role he played. In fact, it was an incredibly key role. As a permanent secretary, if you don't sort of perhaps so familiar with English politics, a permanent secretary in Whitehall's hierarchical structure basically ranked Sir William as high as a head of MI5 or MI6. But as a filmmaker or as an artist or as a person in our industry, he's got like 160 films to his name, so 30 years worth of experience. What I think is really interesting about this is that his experience is not only in making the effects, but also managing and coming up with the strategy for the companies. Because Framestore has gone on to become the biggest visual effects house in Europe. Arguably the biggest, I guess, and I only say arguably because, as we'll explore in the next hour or so, is it even right to think of these companies as being London or European facilities, given how big and how far their influence has spread, and just basically what a global player a company like Framestore is?
The very large effects movies were being made by people who were West Coast based as directors, and George Lucas, obviously, you know, his ambitions and his filmmaking really, you know, was the engine which got things going in many ways. And obviously Star Wars, you know, it still goes back to that being the point that kicked it off, and therefore ILM obviously had a natural starting point and someone driving them to achieve results. So,
but I mean, if you're right, I mean, the very name Framestore, you know, just sort of alerts one to the fact that you were coming through at the edge of the digital revolution, and of course, didn't have a lot of baggage from a pre-digital age.
Oh, completely. Well, the name was a deliberate. I mean, the name was, you know, the Harry, you know, was technically a Framestore. We were selling frames, as in 24 or 25 frames a second. And we liked the idea of the American drugstore, you know, the sort of the 30s and 40s, you know, drugstore thing and that. So, yep. So we saw ourselves selling frames, and the device that we were using that we founded the company on the back of was a frame store. So you're quite right. We were the first digital, pure digital operation, because the others that existed at the time, the existing editing houses and that, obviously we're using analog. Traditionally, people like ourselves are sort of seen, and potentially see ourselves, but certainly seen as at the bottom of the food chain. And this applies whether in the advertising part of our industry or in the studio film side of the industry, where obviously you have the studio, the director, and everybody else, sort of, and you work your way down through the system, and then, as you say, we obviously execute the pictures, but we're commissioned by other people. And we're in a stage, and that's, you know, for me, I've never seen myself, and we've luckily, with the people that we've worked with over the years, never quite seen myself like that. I've seen myself as someone who's helping a director or a studio achieve the vision that they wanted to do in the film they want to make. And actually, I've always felt people came to us because they wanted us to add something to their ambition, not just execute it. You know what I mean? I'm working alongside helping someone make something as opposed to just taking a series of instructions which I'm mindlessly carrying out. So with that in mind, if you then add what is happening in the film business this past few years, where there's huge pressures on budgets, there's people wanting to make films for a certain price point and so forth, and given that the digital part and the visual effects part, both physical and digital, has moved from being 5 or 10% of a movie to anything up to 50, 60% of a movie. And if you look at, obviously, the top 20 or top 50 films, you know what I mean? They all have significant visual effects elements, even when they are ostensibly live action, if you know what I mean.
So it's worth going back and trying to imagine what it was like in England, because in the time that we're talking about in this podcast, which is really spanning the last 10, 15 years, or certainly in the time since FX Guide's been going, obviously FX Guide started in 99, we've seen the London facilities grow to a point where they are these enormous powerhouses competing on the world stage. But I thought I would take an opportunity to go back and discuss some of the history of how some of these companies got established and piece together some of the significant milestones, such as you'll hear the film Lost in Space, which was a real point, certainly as an outsider looking into the UK, where you got a bunch of companies that really bandied together and provided the effects on a single film in a way that now we take for granted, but back then was quite a revolutionary. And it was a real, as I was in Australia, we were a similar sort of outsider looking in at Hollywood. This was London just being clever, just being very aggressive in getting its pricing, of course, and competing well, but then banding together for the common good. And certainly from my perspective, was a real turning point in watching the houses move from their commercials background, which was very strong, and also some of their television work. And, you know, some, of course, special visual effects, as we saw in the Bond films. But at that point, they really banded together and turned the corner, in my eyes anyway, as a real force to be reckoned with in digital visual effects.
We were world-class and considered leaders in commercials, in advertising, in images. So it wasn't that we didn't have an industry. We had an industry that worked at video resolution. And because we were very lucky that our advertising community, you know, was very had a very high profile in those days and was creating some of them, some very interesting global campaigns were coming out of London. And so by definition, going back 40 years, there's always been a very strong filmmaking community making advertising, and so therefore we had something to build upon. So therefore the step from that to working on feature films was a more natural one from a base of skills, as opposed to having to create them from nothing, if you know what I mean.
In the early days when we started Double Negative 13-14 years ago, there was an established post-production community in London, but it was very much based around television post-production, predominantly commercials and some long-form broadcast. There was a nascent core of film visual effects people going all the way back to the 1980s with the Computer Film Company in terms of digital film visual effects. And even before that, there were companies like Magic Camera, which go all the way back to the 70s, making miniatures and models and optical effects for films.
Major films were being made in the UK, and we always have a very strong physical effects reputation. So the model makers and the physical effects, so those guys were well regarded. So the digital ones that we didn't have a reputation for, because at that point obviously the ILMs and that of this world were the only options because of Lucas's support. So we had not yet transitioned, because really, as you correctly say, people in Hollywood didn't perceive London as having capacity or skills. And so Lost in Space really was the beginning of the industry, of the digital part of the industry happening. I mean, that was the first movie made in the UK as a collaborative amongst a number of houses, what is now recognized as a, you know, standard way of making movies in various parts of the world, you know.
The first biggish one really was Lost in Space for New Line. And that enabled people to really, the UK companies really, to have the opportunity to show off their craft, I suppose, or show and try to illustrate to Hollywood that London had a certain amount of capabilities. And I remember at that time, it was like, it was a few hundred shots at the most for each optical stroke digital house. And that kind of filled up London, that one job alone.
Then I think towards the end of the 90s, we began to see several companies set up digital film post-production departments, and Double Negative was kind of part of that. We were set up originally as a purely film-based company. That was our whole thing that we wanted to do, was just concentrate on films. And, you know, it was fairly small business to begin with. Our first film was a movie called Pitch Black, which had about 200 shots in it, which we shared with the Magic Camera Company. But now, of course, I think London's established itself primarily through things like the Harry Potter franchise, and I think to a certain extent through the Batman franchise that we've been working on over at Double Negative. And other companies have built fantastic relationships with directors and studios, both at home and overseas. And so I think London is now seen as a centre of excellence and of quality, and also it has the capacity to deliver large films. So it's it seems to be self-sustaining now, I think.
Nearly 20 years on, not far off 18 to 20 years on, you know, now one house could accomplish Lost in Space, and, you know, we could do 5, 6 to 10 major Hollywood blockbusters simultaneously. Not necessarily a cine site, but certainly with the main UK visual effect facilities, especially in London, who are obviously of a certain size now and a certain capability that can absorb these huge blockbuster movies. And equally, Hollywood has the confidence, I feel, to come to London, both from physical aspect of filming here, but also finishing the film here in terms of, you know, high-end visual effects. And that gave Hollywood a great confidence to say, yes, the skills, I mean, you look at all the Harry Potter franchises that have been produced here, Hollywood doesn't like unnecessary risk, and they like a good deal, like any business. They like to get a good product at the right price. And, you know, the challenge is always for both CineSite and the other companies and the industry generally in the UK to be accommodating to that and recognise that. And currently, it's the best and cheapest place in the world to make a movie. That's without a shadow of a doubt, which is why there is, you know, a big, healthy body of work in the UK at this moment in time, and probably why some of the Los Angeles, particularly Los Angeles companies, are not having such a great time as they used to.
Of course, we're not just talking about visual effects in terms of feature films, and obviously it's easy to focus on that, and that's probably one of the most high-profile ways to look at it. We've already heard there's a lot of other work to be considered, but one of them in particular is the area of television and the work that was done in television, not only for the UK but for the American market. I think this is a really important point, because a lot of the commercial stuff was still locally based. A lot of television work has always been done by companies in their own market. But there was a pivotal point where the UK company started delivering really comprehensive visual effects for episodic and for sort of miniseries for the American market, as you'll hear now as I speak again to Anthony Hunt.
The company has a background clearly in film. The Cineon system that Kodak did was primarily aimed at film. And yet the company has had also parallel a lot of success in television, and I was wondering if you could talk about that, because I'm, you know, personally a huge fan of some of the work your company's done in television and miniseries work, and that has become a really interesting thing in the last sort of decade, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has, and I think the pinnacle was the last big miniseries we did, which was Generation Kill for HBO. Which was a fantastic success story for us, and in fact, from doing that TV series, because of the photorealism of the work that we carried out, because people knew what, you know, Iraq should look like, and nothing really kicked out as digital work at all. It was absolutely seamless work. By doing that miniseries and getting an Emmy Award for it, it really put CineSite on a map for what we call totally photoreal environments, and a great deal of our work since we completed that TV series has led to, for instance, Battle Los Angeles, which we did last year for Sony Imageworks. That was a direct reference off really the work from Generation Kill. Banner Brothers was a fantastic success for CineSite, and that was with Angus Bickerton as well, who I originally worked with at Magic Camera, and obviously he went on to supervise Lost in Space, but he was a supervisor for Banner Brothers, a fantastic TV series. So the visual effect work should fit, you know, shouldn't be taken center stage, but it was, you know, sympathetically done and worked out with the script, and I think that the work in itself was great. The TV series was fantastic, as was Generation Kill, as is Rome, and that makes it easier, you know, when the visual effects shouldn't be leading the work. It should all be about the story and the characters and everything else, and CG or the visual effects has just got a part to play in the series. But it was worked up very well, and all of those were a great success for both CineSite and the client.
easy to jump from commercials straight to features in discussion, but I think that would be doing a disservice to the enormous amount of work you did in episodic and television work, because there's a lot of television work that Framestore did that really was recognised both in Europe and in America, for that matter.
Well, very well. I mean, well, you know, again, we were, you know, it was a very steady stepping stone. We were very clear that we weren't trying to conquer the world in that space. You know, it was a stepping stone, and you correctly identified that the television work allowed us to make that transition and learn the skills. So again, by the time we arrived at film, you know what I mean, we had the, because, you know, as you say, we moved from short form, which was the 30, 60-second commercial, to the sort of long form, which were the 30-minute episodes or the one-hour episodes, to the mini-series, you know, et cetera. So we were very lucky that we were able to move through the different types. And for us, the two big milestones for us in terms of visual effects that people look back and we look back on, one was Walking with Dinosaurs, which was obviously a television production.
And absolutely revolutionary at the time. I mean, it really...
Yeah.
Just, I mean, it's almost hard to imagine how much impact that had, seeing that kind of, it seemed like Jurassic Park without the budget, and at such an engaging level. It was just completely revolutionary.
And we were very lucky because, you know, we partnered with a producer who, you know, had this insane idea of trying to do what was, you know, because he'd obviously been trying to get it going. And so he was a BBC producer who, you know, we, you know, came in to us, and unlike many other people, we didn't think he was crazy. And we thought this would be cool if we could pull it off. So we did effectively a joint venture in which we sat down and tried to work up 60 seconds of imagery to see how crazy the idea was. So that was one thing that gave us a degree of confidence in that and skills, which obviously we didn't have in short form. And the other thing then was the miniseries. I mean, the other major milestone was Gulliver's Travels, which we did with NBC back in, it was 96 and that. And again, that was, again, moving from, you know, the 30-minute things, which the episode Walking with Dinosaurs, storytelling in 30-minute blocks to effectively storytelling in 90-minute movies, which is what the miniseries were. There were two 90-minute slots on the holiday weekends normally. And we did a series of those, Gulliver's Travels, Merlin, Alice in Wonderland, you know, Jason the Argonauts, you know, the whole big NBC sort of projects. And again, so by the time we came to doing film, you know what I mean, we had taken, we were doing sort of film but at television budgets.
CitySide actually doesn't do commercials. It's we just do long form TV series and basically feature film. So TV is commercials. It's not an era of we exited out that many years before I joined CitySide actually. But in terms of, you know, the current climate in London and certainly for CitySide, it's extremely healthy. And you know, the UK has a great infrastructure now. It's helped because of the Harry Potter series, I suppose, but whereas we used to have just predominantly two studios, being Pinewood and Shepperton, obviously there's more choices now with Elstree Studios in Hertfordshire. There's Longcross, which is developed as the Ministry of Defence base, but is now used for feature films. And Twickenham and Shepperton themselves and Pinewood, all of those studios have had investment put into them, so the sound stages are much better now. You know, the infrastructure of workshops and everything. And, of course, the UK tax deal has made a significant addition to the healthiness of our industry, because without the UK tax deal, we wouldn't be in such a strong place, I don't feel. You know, we can't control exchange rates worldwide.
Government policy has played into that. The British government has made it very attractive to studios to come to the UK. But I think they stay there for the quality, and so hopefully we're building on that now.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting if you think of these visual effects companies as currently a sort of a combination of a creative studio with some sort of technical research facility with a kind of financing and, you know, regional tax incentive scheme all wrapped into one. It's kind of the state of play right now. Kind of amazing, you know, because when I started doing this stuff, it was a struggle just to get anything done. And now I just look at the amount of work our group does in a given week, and we're always sort of looking at each other's stuff, and every week we kind of get a big report showing what everybody's been doing and kind of look at each other's work and monthlies every month. And there are days when I just get sort of chills watching it. I just think, wow, man, there are just some amazing people here doing some stuff. Like, how the hell do they do that? I love it when in my own company I get a piece of work and I say, how the hell did we do that? Did we do that? That's amazing, you know? That's pretty fun. So I do love that part of it still.
The other thing that you know, is interesting is just the collaboration now in London, particularly between the visual effect houses, which is healthy, actually. Yes, they all, you know, the main four, let's say, they've all got their numbers to hit and, you know, need to operate as a profitable businesses. But equally, we share shows now, you know, and I think that's healthy. It's a far more collaborative process over the last sort of 3 or 4 years, or maybe further, actually, since really Harry Potter's franchise kicked in. The studio themselves, being Warner Brothers, wanted that collaboration. They didn't want to put all their eggs in one basket. And of course, as each film progressed on Harry Potter, there became more and more visual effects, and pretty much they used, you know, some of the American companies less and less as well. Like on the first movie, you know, ILM had a very big part to play in the movie. By the time they got to number two or number three on Harry Potter, it was becoming less and less, and, you know, the UK companies was doing more and more at the same time as attracting other Hollywood films as well. So it's been a nice, collaborative, healthy growth over the last 18 years. I would like to think a sensible growth as well.
I mean, it's a slight illusion also to think that the collaborative effort happens in the execution of the work. We do kill one another in competition to secure it in the first place.
Absolutely, but I mean, it's also the case that, and I mean this as a compliment, that the English facilities have shown remarkable ability to work together, to share assets, to make the films work.
Yeah.
And and obviously everyone's competitive on a budget, but but if the English houses had sort of ripped each other's throats out, it would have been bad for the English film community as much as anyone. And yet, of course, that wasn't the case.
Absolutely. No. Once the project's allocated, then we're all partners. You know what I mean, so once the competitive bit is done, then you are all making the same movie and you're all working together to deliver a movie, and that's very clear. You know what I mean? And it would be taken badly if one company was being deliberately awkward to another one. It would be inappropriate.
But just to focus on Framestore for a second, you have done tremendously well in establishing just Framestore alone as an entity. I mean, obviously, Avatar was a good example of that, where you and Weta and ILM were all contributing to a film. And of course, now moving forward, you're working on projects that are even larger than that.
Yeah. Well, funny enough, I mean, on that one is interesting because we had all three of us on the same call talking about the same shot with Jim Cameron in LA. So, I mean, that was a real milestone of three time zones. You know what I mean? And three creatives plus the director all on the same call. It was interesting. But actually, I've got to give a lot of credit to ILM, because we did a number of projects with ILM early on, where like Sleepy Hollow, where they were very collaborative with us. I mean, they were the main people, and we were sort of a smaller part of the equation. And they made it very easy. You know what I mean? The collaboration that happened between us and ILM was something that I don't necessarily know whether it existed on the West Coast, but certainly there were no issues about collaboration because both sides wanted to make it work.
Okay, which all brings us round to this question of what is the UK industry and how global is it? Because as you heard at the outset, we have companies that are known as the four sort of London houses, but two of them are part of very large international groups, one being Kodak and one being the enormous Technicolor. But not only that sort of corporate link, but just the spreading of the talent around the world. For example, DNEG has offices in Singapore, and the other facilities have offices in India and Vancouver and elsewhere. Just how global is this industry, and how much are we actually needing to even think anymore of these facilities as being London-based houses? A question I put to Anthony Hunt.
I think ultimately it's a true global industry now, and where everything was about everything in Hollywood, it's not now. It's where can you have a facility that's got good infrastructure, got good track record, and equally where there's a healthy, trained body of staff, and you can get encouraging tax relief. Now, in case of the Far East, India, China, Singapore, Hong Kong, etc., labour rates are cheaper there. There's no tax deals. It's pure factor of economics that you can reduce your labour costs in those regions. In the case of Canada and now Australia, have some very attractive tax concessions, particularly for post-production. And it's kind of a non-brainer because for the sake of Canada, you know, it's 2-hour shuttle flight. You know, the time zones are very sympathetic to Hollywood. And it works extremely well. And like London, you know, 10 to 12 years ago, Vancouver has had a nice steady, particularly Vancouver, more than any other state, more than Toronto or Montreal. But Vancouver has got a nice, healthy infrastructure now of a few stages, sound stage or studios there. And companies have developed there because they've had scripts, you know, and the studios wanting their resources, particularly because of the tax deal. But as people get used to working on good films and good scripts, they're honing in their craft, and each time you do a movie, you get better at it. And I think that's been the case for quite some time now in the UK.
But the London houses, as with the case of many of the top houses around the world, are now diversifying globally. And it isn't really fair to refer to DNEG as a London-based facility because it does a bit of a disservice to your Singapore office.
Yes, absolutely, it does. It's. I think a lot of the companies are now moving towards a more multinational base. You see the commercials companies, the companies that work in the commercials area, opening offices in New York and California, and installing small setups directly into advertising agencies all around the world. Obviously, Double Negative, we've got our Singapore facility, which we are, you know, growing steadily, I think, in a sort of organic, sustainable way. But also most of our business is from overseas. We work with studios from all over the world. Obviously, a lot of it comes from Hollywood, but there are, you know, we're working with European companies, and we're happy to work with anybody, really, because I think creativity is a universal language. It's everywhere, and, you know, it crosses all borders. DNEG, we're just around about 1,200 staff now, most of which are in London. We've got over 1,000 people, I think, on the London site, and then there's about 150 over in our Singapore studio.
Probably the big change in our industry overall is that right now it's not enough to just be a bunch of smart guys somewhere. You have to be able to handle size, and you have to be able to handle growth and flexible workforces, and you never know what movie you're doing next and what the requirements will be. So I guess we get so caught up in all of just making it happen that I don't always think of us in a, you know, London sense, or in a, I guess I would say we're more of a global sense then. I do think of us all the companies and all the sites and all the people around the world as really pretty much being one team. I think that's pretty true.
There's two different trends there. There's where work gets shared out to other companies, or where work gets shared out to your own team that's in other places. And there are challenges. There are things that work and don't work. But in general, it's easier when it's your own team in another country, you know. And because quite many people are part of the same team or not. And it certainly, if you look at the trend across, you know, many of the studios, that's where the direction everybody's gone. And, you know, mainly budget driven, but not always.
I think that CineSci has grown because of the Kodak brand, and Kodak has predominantly been in, you know, feature film, and certainly in America they used to just shoot all their pilots and TV on film, but unfortunately that has dropped off. And, you know, it's challenging times for Kodak for the future of, you know, the amount of digital cinemas that are around, and equally film that's not run through a camera now, and everyone's going digital or shooting in stereo. And for a company like CineSci, we kind of sit still very well, because whether it's shot on film or whether it's shot digitally, it makes no difference to us. We will still do the visual effects, and it's that was kind of the reason why Kodak got into, you know, having a digital company, that was to go with the technology, to be a bit of a shop window to the international film industry, to say, yeah, we've got a company in London that can do these high-end visual effect feature film work, and you know, it's part of our company portfolio. And it's been a great success story, and particularly since, I would say, 2006, when we did The Golden Compass, again with New Line, strangely enough. that was shared between us and CFC Framestore. And that's where, you know, going back to my earlier point about good, healthy collaboration between companies, it was almost too, it was too big a movie for one company to do, and it, there wasn't enough post-production time based on the size of the company, so it was a sensible split down the middle. And of course, that went on to get a, an Academy Award.
MPC as a global entity is kind of interesting because, so we're part of this Technicolor creative group, and they picked MPC up a number of years ago as they were trying to redefine themselves globally. And what we've done is we've sort of used their support to address some things they wanted to do strategically, but also offer a kind of nice set of alternatives just for the MPC directors and studios that we work with. So it's when, as I sit every day and I do my dailies, and that might include talking to someone in Vancouver who's working on part of a shot for us, or someone in India who's working on a part of a shot for us, I am very much thinking that I'm just in our group. You know, we don't tend to think of ourselves as part of a conglomerate or something, because we have the same pipelines everywhere, and a lot of the teams that run our facilities in India and in Vancouver have come from London, and they're people we've worked with, and we're all friends, and we know each other, and they come over here quite a lot, and our teams from London go to those places quite a lot. So it's kind of cool. It's not easy to do these multi-time zone workflows. I would say it's hard, and it remains hard. But it seems to be a necessity to be competitive. And I think the Technicolor support has allowed us to build that in a fairly robust fashion, along with the kind of technical gusto that some of the people here in London have in terms of their... I've always said MPC's been a very brave company in the things it's taken on, and this was no exception. I mean, we really... I think we're probably, I would sort of think of us and ILM, maybe Rhythm and Hughes, as the people who are doing this well. I know of other companies who, even in the same time zone, are struggling to have more than one site, because it's not trivial to run all of your software and expand your brain trust.
And as Adam says, there are many companies trying to do this around the world, but it is a very difficult problem. There are various models you can use for having remote locations. Obviously, one of them, and the one that most people focus on, is this idea of just having some kind of digital sweatshop overseas with cheaper labor that you can send uncreative work to, that's going to work at a cheaper hour per rate. But this isn't actually what we're primarily talking about. The companies that we're sort of talking to today, and those such as Adam mentioned, Rhythm and Hughes, ILM, etc., are not just farming out work. They're not just trying to somehow exploit workers in the third world or something. These are highly technical areas. The Rhythm and Hughes guys in India contributed major shots. The guys at ILM Singapore, the guys that have work in the various offices of MPC, are not there just because they've got cheap labor rates. They're there because they're talented artists, and the pool is allowing the company to tap into that very talented work overseas. This is a really important thing to understand, because it's a really complicated issue. And the issue isn't just one of, well, can I sync what time of the day to call each other? It's much, much more complicated than that. For example, ask yourself this question. If you're in the IT department of MPC, what time of day do you roll out an update to software? Because almost at any time of the day, you're going to actually disrupt someone in the middle of their day, because the middle of the night, your time, which is obviously a good time for rolling out software, is the middle of their day. What data do you sync? Do you sync everything, which is a huge amount of data to be moving across the world just so things are in sync? And what's the latency in that sync time? And I mean, some things perhaps don't even need to be synced. For example, there's not much point perhaps in syncing between remote locations SIM data, which can be vast amounts of data if a SIM is being done in just one location. And as I said, this idea of having creative sort of offices is something that the London houses are doing well, and not just MPC. I posed the question to Paul Franklin of DNEG, because DNEG has Nathan McGuinness, who used to run Asylum, heading up their Singapore office. And of course, Nathan, very experienced and very talented, exceptionally well-respected VFX supervisor in his own right, is just one of many people that really has a major role to contribute for, in this case, DNEG Singapore.
Absolutely. You know, it's, Nathan is bringing a wealth of experience to the facility over in Singapore. But it's more than that. You know, the Singaporean population are very highly educated. They're very technologically savvy. The country has been very aware of the importance of developing its technological sector and the relevance of technology with media. And so it's absolutely not second best in any way at all. And our intention is that the facility in Singapore eventually is fully capable of handling its own large-scale jobs. It's certainly not an outsourcing facility in the sort of traditional sense of, oh, we'll get this done cheaper elsewhere.
So tell me, how is it working in the community right now? Is it the case that if a major director wants to get a film up, it really doesn't matter where they are in the world to film it as to who is likely to bid to get it? Because obviously you go back a few years and even to a certain extent with the Harry Potter thing, in many people's minds it's seen as being something that was filmed in England, hence it makes sense for the England houses. But I mean, for example, the Batman series that you're on,
yes,
it's not a London-based thing that has to be done in London.
No, not at all. It's based out of Chris Nolan's house, primarily in Hollywood. The thing there is that the first film, Batman Begins, was something that did have to be largely done in the UK because of the tax incentives, I think, that Warner Brothers were taking advantage of. But also, you know, Chris wasn't going to compromise. He doesn't compromise on anything, I can assure you of that. He wanted to make absolutely sure he had the best possible result from every aspect of his film. And he surrounded himself with some very, very talented people. And, you know, the studio gave him the budget to be able to do that. And I guess, you know, we established ourselves as being somebody he could rely on to do his work. And so he will, you know, he's been coming back to us. He doesn't, you know, haven't worked exclusively with Double Negative. He's also worked with Boof. He worked with them on Batman Begins, The Dark Knight, and then The Prestige, where they handled that show. But it comes down to personal relationships you build up. You know, I was standing on set with Chris today, discussing all manner of visual effects related subjects, and it's a dialogue that you build up, and then he, you know, that's I think what brings him back. In terms of our physical location, if anything, it actually can work to the filmmaker's advantage. During post, of course, I'm back in London with my team at Double Negative, and we do all our VFX dailies via CineSync, you know, this marvelous piece of software that Rising Sun came up with a few years ago, which is extremely flexible and easy to use, and it allows you to do dailies basically across a telephone line and across the internet. And the time zone difference actually works to our advantage because we get notes and then we can work on the shots whilst, you know, everybody over in LA is in bed. And then also another thing is that at the end of our day, they might think of new things to do, but we've gone home and we're able to sleep. So, you know, it works both ways, I think.
And layered with that kind of lightweight internet availability, you've also set up large, heavy-duty pipes with things like SohoNet and stuff, so that yes. Warners can have secure transfers that don't even go through the internet.
Yes, absolutely.
So you actually sort of have like you've closed that distance thing and presumably the time zone at the same time.
Yeah, definitely. And it also works internally within the country itself. For instance, when we're working on the Harry Potter films, we're based in Soho, and the Harry Potter production team had its base out at Leavesden Studios, which is north of London in Watford. And that takes, you know, it's a good hour and a half's car journey or similar amount of time if you want to go by train. So it's not something you can't just nip over there. And, of course, they're very busy. They're working relentlessly. Those films often overlapped, were made pretty much back to back. So it wasn't possible often for the visual effects supervisor to get down to Soho and review the work with the VFX facilities. So they would do their visual effects dailies as a series of CineSync sessions, rolling through the afternoon, you know, and if you were one of the vendors working on those shows, you would have your slot, you'd fire up CineSync, and then, you know, bam, you'd be into it.
Because I would say that the film industry particularly is one of the areas which crosses industry and, you know, technology and the creative arts very well indeed. And it illustrates that time and time again. And it's kind of new technology in some respects. It's kids are coming out of university, particularly in our sector in post-production, with skills that they're using, you know, and have been using on a day-to-day. And the technology is been moving so fast, you know, certainly for visual effects and probably gaming, which is another area which has seen great growth in the UK, which we're not involved in. But again, it's had a part to play in the success story of you know, digital technology and advancement in a creative medium in the UK.
So we are pretty critical to the delivery of a movie and a vision of it, you know, A, on time, and B, you know, within a budget and feasible and so forth. And we haven't always been very involved in the process, not by our choice, but by people just not involving us, either because they didn't want to or didn't see the relevance of us being involved. And, you know, so in pre-production meetings 10 years ago, you didn't necessarily always have a visual effects presence. You had a costume people, you had a camera crew, you had, you know what I mean? But our department, so to speak, was never always represented with some strength, and we were quite often seen as more junior people, you know, on the creative team and that.
As we get more and more films come through, you know, that there is only a certain amount of labor pool currently, certainly in the UK, and there is a skill shortage without a shadow of a doubt in certain key areas of CGI, I would say. Programming skills, 2D effects, shader writers, these are skills that are actually paid very well, but we are in dire lack of in the UK. I don't know why, whether universities are not producing enough physicians or mathematicians who find, you know, writing programs for creative content, don't see it as a career. I think there's an educational process that needs to be played here. I think it's the bigger companies, to be honest, generally, that basically need to attract the big films and have a sustainable pipeline in place that can accommodate it. I mean, the work, for instance, we're doing on John Carter of Mars and World War Z at the moment are extremely, I mean, it's the most complex stuff I've ever seen in my 33 years in the industry. It's, you know, 10 years ago, probably, I know we would not have been capable, both CineSite or anyone else in the UK, of doing this type of work. But the technology and the skilled artists have, as I said earlier, have honed their game, have got better. Software and hardware has come down in price, thank God. And, you know, all of these things collectively, you know, are part of the puzzle to make a beautiful picture.
So let's turn our attention now to the industry itself in the UK and what it basically is composed of and how significant it is to the UK economy. Now, the overall IT and computer sort of industry is obviously pretty massive, but I just want to focus in on just the visual effects, and we have some really good stats on that from some work that was done recently in the UK, in fact published earlier this year, end of last year. And we know, for example, that 40% of people that are working in SOHO are CG artists. They would be modelers, effects and lighting people. 15% of them are compositors, and 10% are involved in R&D. And a further 10% are in production and project management. The workforce is also highly qualified, and it's rewarded as such. In fact, it's a great area to be in the English facilities right now. You'll be earning above your sort of average salary for the industry category, or for that matter, for the general category. So, for example, if I was somebody working in the UK right now, on average, I'd be earning about £45,000. Where if I was in IT, I'd be earning about, I don't know, £39,000, £40,000. But if I was in the motion picture industry in general, if I was just a general kind of person involved in film production or sound recording or whatever, I'd be only earning £34,000. And this, as I say, not only reflects the really high level of skills for these people, but also the scarcity of talent that's meant that the UK has had to import a lot of artists. Because while we hear gloom and doom about the visual effects industry quite often, there is in fact more visual effects work done globally each year than ever before, and the UK houses have done a really good job in grabbing a very sizable chunk of that work. What about the health of the industry moving forward? What are the issues looking forward? What are the formats? What is the nature of where the industry's at in terms of CG, R&D, HD? A question I put to Sir William Sargent.
You start with the fact that there are cycles and ebbs and flows within each of them. So, you know what I mean? It's a cyclical business within a year or within a 2 or 3 year cycle. So, you know, all three of them have their ups and downs within any 2 year period or 3 year period. The demand for digital imagery obviously has grown and continues to. So the actual number of digits that people want, you know, images created from continues to grow. The requirement for them in any film continues to grow. The amount of money that people have or want to spend per second or per minute goes down, because by definition, if you follow Moore's law, in theory, you know, you can render more for less time and less money and so forth. So the natural ambition of the director, of the directors, and the natural ambition of artists is to put more into a picture, and therefore you're either effectively you're constantly innovating and reducing prices. So you're always under margin pressure, always under price pressure, to do more for less, or the same for more, or whatever. You know what I mean? And there's nothing new about this. This is, you're talking about 25 years of this just being, you know, constant. So when people say, oh, you know, there were good times and there weren't good times, the reality is, you know, this is a constant. And one of the things that's made our industry strong and innovative is the desire to see more ambitious images from movie to movie, and or in commercial to commercial, or, you know what I mean, et cetera. So we're in a business where we, as managers and our artists, as creators, you know, always want to do more and better than they did last week or last month or last year. So I don't see the demand for what we do going away over the next decade. Now, the supply changes all the time, so there are times when you have oversupply because people might not make so many movies for 6 months. You know, a writer's strike or a director's strike, or, you know, we've had a couple of cycles over a decade where there was glitches in production flows. So that's one of the big trends. The other big trend that I perceive, so sorry, when you ask me about, you know, do you make a load of money in one sector and it funds the other sector, the answer is no. They've all pretty much evened out, in my opinion, that yes, you can make a living in all three of them as long as you are genuinely dedicated to that sector, that you're not actually doing it in order to fund another sector. We've seen people come a cropper in that particular space.
Surely the Moore's Law thing would be more likely to affect the commercial end of the market first, because theoretically, you know, television has only basically got standard definition and HD, and those goalposts haven't moved dramatically. So it's easier today than it ever was before to digitally edit something and do a few simple effects yourself. So that,
yeah,
democratization.
But compare the tools. Well, compare what you can do on a Mac today to 2 years ago, even. You know what I mean? And, you know, look at now, you can buy a smoke license for, I can't remember the figure, $10,000 or something. You don't need to buy the hardware that came with it. You know, if you go back to 3 to 4 years ago, you had to buy the whole package. Now, for $10,000, you know, on your existing Mac, you can put a license on there and get on with doing, you know, what years ago, 5, 10 years ago, cost you $250,000 to buy.
Interestingly, there's been a lot of attention in the move into 3D, and of course a lot of attention over the massive swing towards digital capture. But you intrigue me, because your vision moving forward has those elements, of course, but also a trailblazing role in shooting very high resolution, in particular some of the projects you've done and are continuing to do that have shot with IMAX and stuff. Can you talk to me about that? Because it's a bit of an island, really, of expertise almost, it feels like, that you've developed in this very high resolution capturing area.
Well, yes. I mean, obviously, that's primarily come from the work that we've been doing with Chris Nolan, who is an absolute champion for photochemical film. Well, what he's a champion of resolution and quality. And at the moment, the way to get the best possible quality, the maximum possible resolution, is to shoot it photochemically with an IMAX camera. Or in the case of Inception, we shot with 65mm cameras, as well as doing all our 4K, anamorphic post-production at 4K. So we're always pushing the envelope there. But what I think it really comes down to is that cinema, I mean, what I'm talking about is proper cinema, going into a big theater and looking at a really big screen with an audience and having that communal group experience and seeing that amazing image which just fills your vision and takes over your world for the 2 hours or so that you're in the cinema. It relies on image quality. It relies on the depth of color. It relies on the resolution of the image, the scale of the image, in the case of IMAX, just completely filling your vision. And that's something that cinema still provides that can't be matched by home entertainment. You know, no matter how expensive your plasma screen, your LCD TV, LED TV, whatever it is, it will not match the quality of a really, really well set up cinema. And And I think that's where this drive for pushing the resolution, pushing the quality actually comes from. Ultimately, I think the home systems will catch up with this, not for quite a few years, because I think we've established standards for HD TV and things like that, which are going to, you know, stay around for quite a while. But, you know, digital cinemas are already moving towards 4K projectors. We're seeing 4K capture with films like the Arri Alexa and the Phantom. So it's a visual arms race, I guess, going on all the time. You know, and cinema is always trying to stay ahead of television in order
not,
to...
Not to correct you, but unless you know something I don't, I think you might need the Red camera rather than the Alexa, because I think...
Oh, sorry. Yes, I'm getting confused, yeah.
Unless you've got a prototype I don't know about. but actually, those 4K images obviously are breathtaking and great, and we've heard a lot about those. But on Dark Knight, you did like 5.6 and 8K.
Yes, that's true.
And I know that you and I were twittering and chatting backwards and forwards publicly about the fact that you capture plates. I think you actually said 65 mm, 15 perf, is that right?
Yes, that's it. That's what IMAX, full app IMAX, is 65mm, 15 perf. The film runs through the gate horizontally, so you're using the 65mm width of the negative is actually the full height of the frame, and then it is 15 perforations wide. So you end up with a frame which is a decent-sized postcard, the actual frame on the negative. You can clearly make out detail on the thing. I think I tweeted an image of a bit of discarded 65mm stock, which... I guess our main unit, camera department, had just dropped in the street in Pittsburgh where we were filming there a few weeks ago, and it's enormous stuff. You know, 65mm. It's a substantial chunk of film.
So I guess the question is there an end play to this arms race? Is it? Do you feel like at that level, you know, you're getting everything you want, and thanks very much for playing, or do you see this escalating further?
You know, it really very much depends on the quality of the display systems which are ultimately invented. I think it's possible to capture images at even higher resolution than IMAX. You know, there are digital systems which will do this, experimental systems, but playing it back, projecting it is obviously a different matter altogether. An IMAX projector is not a cheap piece of equipment. I think they cost about $1 million to install. So there aren't very many of them. There's only a couple of hundred of them left in the world, I think, now, because they're being slowly replaced by the digital systems. But, I don't see any reason why there would be a limit to it.
I think for me, we're getting to a place right now where lighting and rendering is still one of the hardest things to do in the top sort of 5%. I mean, everybody now kind of is using very similar approaches to things, but it remains a very, very difficult craft to master. And I think I've seen over the years this relationship between how real the image looks and then how real the 3D objects have to be. And I feel right now like we need to, everybody, and I don't just mean NPC, but everybody needs to look at how we can continue to refine and up the look of deformations and cloth and animation and all that stuff. Because I'm not a major fan of motion capture as a silver bullet. I think it's cool, but I've worked with it enough to know that it's a part of a solution, and that animators are basically right now in the visual effects part of the world definitely putting in some major intensive hours to try to generate stuff that looks natural and fluid and still has some character to it. Because
can I get you to qualify that? Are you saying that if we had a scale, a balance between an object looking real as a still and looking real in terms of its motion, which of those two do you think is behind compared to the other? Have we got better looking images or better looking movement?
Yeah, I guess I'd say I feel like right now the image is starting to edge over. And it's ironic because I'm an animator first, and I don't, if I'm honest with you, my photorealism is not my personal goal as an individual artist. It's absolutely what we're here to do, and we all pursue it really diligently, and so do I. But it's like I love it when the movies really grab you and take you along, and I'm not always convinced that we're always everybody is collectively spending their money always in the right way there. Sometimes obsessing too much about the photorealism thing as opposed to just making a great movie or making a great scene. And I would say at the moment it's becoming a little bit more standardized how to get that photoreal image than the movement and the deformation of things and how they move. Yeah. So I'd say at the moment it's like they rely on each other completely, you know, like as one goes up, the other has to match it. And we're just in this place lately where it feels to me, if I look at all the animation across the world that's being done in visual effects, it's really hard right now to live up to that standard, and I think that's why you're seeing more motion capture being introduced. People are trying to attain it, and it's not an easy thing to do right now, and it's not, the tools are quite dated in their approach to making things move right. I haven't seen any new ideas for a while, so that's something that I'm personally interested in. It may just be my thing, but that's what I'm keen to see.
I was reading about the history of the development of PAL television, you know, phase alternating line, the system that we had in the UK from 1969 through until, well, it still runs, but it's being replaced by HDTV. And it was described as a high-definition system because it was high-definition in comparison. Well, actually, 405 line before that was considered to be high-definition compared to the original Baird system of TV, which was only 40 scanning lines, I think. So, It's a matter of perception, I think, also. At the moment, I think a lot of people go to an IMAX cinema and they see that image and they might think, well, that looks like reality. That looks really real. It's so clear. It's so sharp. You know, it can't possibly get better than that. But I think the average human being sees the world with much higher definition than you get on any filmed image or any digitally projected image. So I guess perhaps that's the ultimate goal.
Well, that would beg the question, though. I mean, one of the I did this. I was lucky enough to see this in England. It was an old style optical device that basically acted like a pinhole camera and caused the world to be projected on a dish. I think it was in Bristol.
Yes, I've been to the same one. That's the Camera Obscura in Clifton, in Bristol.
Yeah, and the thing I was struck about there was that for the first time I was seeing something that didn't have a frame rate. Because it was reality projected. Yes. And I really noticed the difference. And so I guess my question to you would be, is there a role to be played here in upping the frame rate because you're upping the spatial resolution but not the temporal resolution?
I think you're probably right. It's I had exactly the same experience in exactly that same place, the Camera Obscura in Clifton in Bristol. And, I was looking at the image, which is this flat projected image, but it was... It's the sharpest, brightest image I have ever seen in anything. And what really astounded me is that it's that had been there since the 19th century. You know, people 150 years ago had watched that same image looking across the Clifton Suspension Bridge and into the gorge there, across the River Avon. I think frame rate is a very interesting thing in terms of increasing the resolution of the image. I was reading a little bit about how Walter Murch helped reconstruct the very first, what was considered to be one of the very first films ever shot by Thomas Edison. And they found that there was a sound recording that Edison had made with the shooting of whatever was going on. I can't remember what exactly the subject was. They'd recorded it onto one of these rubber cylinder recorders. And this is something from, I think, 1895 or something ridiculous like that. And they worked out how to synchronize the sound with the image. So it was, in effect, the first sound recording for motion pictures, or at least the earliest surviving one. But what really intrigued me was that the frame rate they worked out, because it was a hand-crank camera, and nobody knew what frame rate should be at that time. So the guy, I guess, was just cranking it as furiously as he could. And it was an apparent frame rate of about 80 frames a second.
Wow.
So the film stock was very, very low resolution by modern standards. I think it was only 16 millimeters wide. And it was the grain size was enormous. But the speed that it was going through the gate meant that the resolution was considerably higher than you would actually expect from a film of that time. What I think comes next from that is an aesthetic choice. You know, I went to see the film Contagion the other night. which is all shot with RED cameras. And I thought it looked fantastic, but a lot of people and people on Twitter disagreed with me and felt that it had a rather gross look, I think one guy described it as. And I was discussing it with my colleagues on set today, many of whom are absolute film diehards. And I said, well, you know, I thought the look was totally appropriate for the subject matter, this sort of immediate, unromantic look of the hard digital camera. And they said, well, you know, that is the exact reason why I would hate it. And so it becomes down to an aesthetic choice. It's a judgment at this point. I think a lot of people are really very much in love with the slightly blurry, slightly impressionistic look of the 24 frames per second frame rate that we use in film, which, I, as far as I know, really has its origins, you know, in technical limitations that go back to be around the time of the First World War. So, but it's now accepted as, well, it's like the brushstrokes of an oil painter or something. So it's an interesting thing as to whether people would really want to see the sort of super high frame rates which digital systems can offer.
So the question is, what defines these London facilities? What separates them? What's it like? And do they really function independently? Or where are they sort of seeing themselves now and their role moving forward?
We started as, you know, the partners basically, you know, are fundamentally the same people in place with some variations. We are modest in our sort of expectations and, you know, just want to do good work and keep it simple. We have never taken money out of the business, you know what I mean? Our view has always been to put it back in and build, because we're in an industry, obviously, where the rainy days turn up on a cycle, you know what I mean? Maybe a long cycle, but they certainly turn up on that. So we've been very simplistic in our way of running the business. We haven't always succeeded because, you know, it's virtually impossible in business to not make mistakes. In fact, and generally, you're probably only moving forward if you're making mistakes.
We primarily try to focus on the craft and collaboration with filmmakers, and that everybody will tell you that. But the thing we're trying to actually do to convert that theory into practice is we've spent a lot of time in the last few years looking at how we organize and run the operation so that we can try to be flexible with the film's needs and the director's process, because every director is different. So I'd say if I had to define MPC primarily in terms of what we were trying to be and where we're going, it's really about being a full partner with the director and accommodating their process. That's the number one thing. And everything kind of frames out from there. The single hardest factor at the moment for everything is time, because, you know, there's that old equation about time and quality and money, and that you can only have two or three or something. And it's like, time for me, though, is the thing that kills the creative process. So you can run a smaller team for longer or a bigger team for shorter. Yes, at some point the extremes of that become a problem for different reasons. You know, if you string a team along for too long, you're going to lose momentum. You're not going to have enough critical mass to turn around shot volume to really help the director see if the movie's going in the right direction. That's a problem. Conversely, you know, we've all heard about the movies recently that are just way too much too fast. And splitting it to multiple houses doesn't help, because then you're trying to manage it across. There's just no way to do it really fast, right? Not get something really great without killing people, right? So there are examples where when financial incentive is just so strong, there is waste, and many, you know, even hundreds of shots get worked on and thrown away. And, you know, in those cases, like I said, you can have a studio that's so behind a movie that really isn't a problem, whereas in another film with, let's say, a smaller marketing budget and less kind of powerhouse film, there's just no way you're going to have waste like that. But in any case, again, I just say time is probably the biggest issue, because when you don't have it, you simply are not going to be making the best film, I think.
But it's challenging times. But, you know, generally there are still, audience takings are up, and people are, the studios like these big franchise movies. They do like, you know, I think it's proven, there's been some recent things in the papers in the UK about, you know, the healthy body of between 15 and 18 year olds going to the cinema, and they all want to watch, you know, a certain type of movie, and that there will always be a place for things like The King's Speech or costume drama particularly. But generally, the studios want these big franchise tentpole movies that almost self-market themselves, that they can churn out one after the other, which, you know, is a shame sometimes, because you really want something true and original, and there's nothing wrong with the franchises.
But you guys managed to work on those tentpole pictures, but you've also done projects like Moon, which was terrific.
That's right. Usually we wouldn't kind of have the resources available to do it, but I read the script and I thought it was a fantastic script. I really enjoyed it, and it was kind of trying to put something back in the UK. You know, we have a healthy training scheme at Cinesite called Inspire, and you know, which is giving opportunity to graduates to get into the film industry and get a break. And Moon was a bit like that with Duncan, the director, because, you know, he was just looking for help, but to give production value to the film, he needed the help of visual effects, and clearly that there wasn't the budget to do it. And you know, we certainly didn't do it for the money, but I think we enabled Andrew and for us as a company to put something back into the British film industry to try and lift and bring some new talent through.
A movie is made of moments, and each of those moments can be told in different ways. And when you're trying to really create an experience that's special, and you know, that phrase we hear all the time, something I haven't seen before, or someplace I haven't been before, it often doesn't require the biggest punch in the face to create that impression. You know, it can be done a lot more with mood and pacing and careful reveals and exactly the design of what you're showing. And that is as hard to do as making something look totally real.
It would be nice if someone came to you and said, I'd really like you to make some scenes that make me feel ways I haven't felt before.
I have to agree. It's like the average story, even of a film that you know is going to have visual effects in it, the average story I find right now isn't bringing to each scene the different levels at which a scene should work. You know, you can have your spectacle level, but you should also have some character going on. You should also have some tension for the audience and something at stake. You know, each scene is a mini story, and what I'm seeing is a lot of scenes where there's a lot of action, and then you cut to the scene where they talk, and then you go back to the scene where there's a lot of action. And I think for me, that proliferates shot count, and that creates a little bit of a problem for everybody. It creates a problem for the director who's trying to get his budget through, for the studio who's trying to afford that movie, for our schedule, you see. So it's kind of more like, how can we make sure that there is planning and the time taken to try to use these effects to their best effect for the audience, you know? And that probably would take... give us all a little bit of a break and allow us to create something a little more special.
And that's an interesting paradigm at the moment, is that the studios themselves, clearly they're cash flowing these massive multi-million dollar productions, and you know, they want to get it out in the box office as quickly as possible, but equally, you know, they want the quality. And sometimes there is always a clash there, because at the end of the day, yes, you can throw a lot of people at it, but it's not always the best solution. And in the case of Moon, that's a prime example. We had a nice period of time, a small crew, who were able to do that job at a fantastic price for that particular independent production.
So let me ask you this. If you were down the pub with a bunch of Soho execs and you happened to all walk into the same pub at the same time and you were having a pint, and the topic came out about what's the kind of thing that is limiting you the most right now, is it getting that client educated for the budgets, or is it the other end of the equation, getting adequate staff to meet the demands? Because even though we all sort of bitch and moan a bit about the state of the industry, obviously a hell of a lot of visual effects are being done on a per hour basis compared to what they were years ago.
Absolutely. I think the biggest challenge is always finding enough qualified and talented staff to fill the slots. I think it's always been the case that there are more space, more seats available than the more open vacancies than there are available people to do them. And that has always been, you know, even when we were, when I worked at the Moving Picture Company nearly 20 years ago, and we had a 3D department of six people, you know, if one person left, we'd all be searching our souls trying to, well, how on earth are we going to replace that one person? Where are we going to find this person? And, you know, now when we're trying to hire, I don't know, 200 artists, it's the, you know, the same situation pertains. So I think, you know, first and foremost, that's always the biggest thing. It's getting artists, creative people, educated to the point where they can actually work in our industry. In terms of working with the clients, I think it's interesting to see how films are evolving. I've noticed recently that you've got a lot of, you know, really quite serious art house film directors, or people who you would think of being at the more intellectual end of filmmaking, who are wholeheartedly embracing the use of very sophisticated, high-end, and very obvious visual effects work to make their films. You know, something like, you know, Lars von Trier's just released his film Melancholia, which clearly has a substantial visual effects content. You know, this is the guy who laid down a whole series of rules, which meant you couldn't do anything other than just point a handheld camera in available light at your subject a few years ago. And, you know, for my own part, working on a film like Inception, which, you know, could be described as a $200 million art house movie. So it's
pretty successful one, though.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is that it showed that actually there is no real division in cinema, that the ideas which work in a film which cost, you know, $100,000 to make and maybe gets shown at a few obscure festivals can actually work in a much larger arena if it's made accessible to large-scale audiences. And how do you do that? Well, you ask me, it's through having a great story and having some really good visual effects.
Well, I think the other thing that I take nothing away from the visual effects, which, of course, as you know, I loved, but I would also applaud the film for not being, let's face it, a redo of a comic book or a reimagining of a previous movie that had only been filmed, you know, 10 years ago. It was fresh and original, and I think that so well executed is one of the reasons why it worked so well.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'm doing my director a slight disservice there. I mean, it's Chris's vision, that film, and it primarily revolves around what he brought to it, and then, you know, the rest of us all add our own piece to it. But I think it's undeniable that the sort of spectacle which large-scale modern movie making brings to things attracts an audience that may not necessarily want to go and see a Lars von Trier film on a regular day.
Well, may I just say that, please, whatever you do, don't stop also making the incredibly cool comic book films that that are original and highly entertaining.
Fear not. I think there's absolutely no danger of that happening anytime soon.
Because I like them too.
Yes, no, we're making a lot of those right now, so I'm very happy to keep doing that.
Well, speaking of which, I should let you get back because it's the end of a long shooting day for you. I know you're on location, so we do appreciate you taking time. And I've got to say, I appreciate all the support you've given FX Guide over the years, so thank you.
It's an absolute pleasure, Mike. I was when I first heard FX Guide all those years ago, and I contacted you. I thought, this is a really cool idea. These guys are doing a fantastic thing here. I want to be part of this, and it was my pleasure to be that.
Well, thank you very much. We appreciate it, and good luck with the film.
All right, thanks, Mike. Take care.
So, looking at all of these things, the thing that you really have to take in, the thing you have to really understand, is that this entire expansion of the UK facilities, this entire growth, this move into feature films, the success creatively in terms of Oscars, this success financially in terms of building such big companies, this growth in terms of opening offices all over the world has been happening over the last 10 or so years. But think about it. During that time, how much gloom and doom have you heard? How much have you heard people publishing that, you know, companies going out of business, that it's not working, that things aren't happening? And before someone says, well, wait a second, that's all down to tax credits, there are other areas that have been offering tax credits. And not only that, but it's not as if the UK is notoriously known as being a cheap labour market. If you think of stuff going offshore, there tends to be a discussion between the US and the rest of the world that has an assumption that the reason that the US may lose business is because it's going to cheap, you know, labor that can be employed for a song and isn't as educated and doesn't have the same kind of standard of living, etc. But none of that's true when you think about the UK. all of this growth, all of this success that we've seen out of the UK houses has not been as a result of having offices in some remote, cheap location that's really, really inexpensive. I mean, London is one of the most expensive cities in the world, and it's not been that they've been paying no salaries. As we said earlier in the show, they're actually paying salaries well above the film industry and significantly above the IT industry. It's certainly not the case that the UK facilities have been doing the work nobody else wanted, because they wouldn't have gone on to win the Oscars. They wouldn't have gone on to have the kind of success they have. In the end, you just have to say that the UK facilities have been working really hard, doing really good work, and being terribly collaborative. That, combined, of course, with industry incentives and a well-organized government plan that dovetails in with industry, has led to the fact that, like it or not, the UK facilities are now some of the most dominant in the world and sit alongside the major US houses as really first-class alternatives for any major production. Now, of course, there are other outcrops such as Weta in New Zealand that have similarly done exactly the same thing. They're not alone, but as a group, as an industry, it's one of the most remarkable achievements of the last 10 years, in my personal opinion. And I think it's nothing but praise to the individuals involved. And I want to thank in particular those that took time to talk to us today. And I want to thank you for being a supporter of FX Podcast for the last umpteen years, over the last 200 shows. I know you've heard a lot of the three of us, and in particular a lot from me. And we want to thank you so much for your time and contribution and your support. Thanks so much. I'm Mike Seymour. See ya.
Well, I got to say, I really enjoyed that podcast. Like I said before, that really kind of parallels what I see of the changes and the stuff that we've been doing in Effects Guide and covering the industry over the years. And now I just got to say, after the 90-minute podcast and four beers listening to it, I'm like, that podcast was epic.
The role of alcohol in the evolution of FX Guide. Lucky we didn't call it cocktail hour in the post suite. I have drunk more than my fair share of tequila with you, my friends.
Yes, indeed.
In NAB, I remember you going especially heavy on the martinis at that Russian bar.
On the espresso martinis, yeah. No, I remember.
I just got mine and I set mine down, and yours was empty.
Yeah, that was my second one was empty. remember? Yes, at one NAB years ago, you guys were trying to get me to go for proper tequila. And I remember Palmer putting out this really expensive sipping tequila in shot glasses. And I was like, oh, we're doing shots, are we? And just knocked it back. And everyone was like, what are you doing? It's just sipping tequila. So I've learned a lot from FX Guide. I've learned about the subtleties of tequila, as well as a lot about the visual effects industry.
Well, we've had so many adventures and fun along the way with, especially the trade shows, because it ends up getting us all together. NAB in particular is almost always the three of us. And, you know,
it's like sleeping on the floor at NAB.
Oh my God.
Maybe not that.
Underneath the projector during one of our FX Guide lives. Yeah, that was fun.
Basically, we had some really bad infrastructure issues going on before one of our FX Guide live events at NAB. And Jeff ended up, I think, sleeping on the floor.
Luckily, yeah. I think I was napping as well in another, under the bottom of the, they had these big cloths that were hanging up at the end of the room, and they were only half hoisted, so I used one of them as a blanket. But I've got to tell you, the other thing that's been really funny for me is doing the April Fool's FX podcasts. I mean, those are the only podcasts that aren't in our iTunes store. They're only ever available on the day, and if you miss them, they're gone. But yeah, and there are a couple that haven't ever gone to air that I think would cause me to be hounded out of the industry. But yeah, it's been fun.
Yeah, those were fun. I especially like the one where we, the April Fool's one where we declared that we had sold the company. And
oh, that was fun.
That was a good one.
Some people started pointing, so you're selling the company. I'd be interested. And we're like, no, we're just joking. Yeah, that's the trouble with time zones, right? It wasn't April Fool's in whichever time zone we published it in, and they thought we were serious. But anyway.
That global economy.
We've actually also had a phenomenal group of people that have agreed to be on the show. I mean, if you look through the running list of people that have, you know, done stuff with, we've obviously had a lot of friends and people that we knew in the industry. But yeah, there's been a heck of a lot of
people. That was for FX Guide TV, but man, that VES festival, where I think in a period of a week or a period of a day, it was like Dennis Muren, Ken Rawls,
Doug Trumbull.
Doug Trumbull. I'm like, talk about pressure. I mean, talking to them, and then like you can hear the toilet flushing in the interview next door, and you know, one of those guys is making jokes about it. I'm like, oh my God.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Such a great experience, and like you say, Mike, the opportunity to meet and talk to so many great people over the years. It's wonderful.
Although we did have fun, I remember there was somebody that we had done some research on everybody before we got there, and you had asked them about a movie that was listed in their credits on IMDb, which they never worked on, and they looked at us like we were crazy, and we were like, "But it's listed in your credits," and they're like, "I know, and I don't know why."
You know what? I that actually happened once to me when I was talking to Thingo from Lord of the Rings. What's his name? You know, the director. God, I'm going to get shot for this. Peter Jackson. And he was in my flame suite. And luckily for me, I knew it wasn't true. But I pointed out that at that time on Peter Jackson's, it was before he did The Lord of the Rings, on Peter Jackson's IMDb credits, it listed him as an extra in Starsky and Hutch. Peter Jackson was like, what? And I said, look here.
Wow, that's like a Wikipedia thing. Somebody's playing around with IMDb.
But I got screwed recently. I was doing an interview at ILM with, I think, Scott Farr, and just that morning, ILM had decided to put up some old Transformers making-ofs, and just as I was stepping out the door, I saw these YouTube clips come up about the old making. But I didn't realize it, right? Because I'm like literally walking out the door in San Fran to get in a car to go to ILM to interview them about Transformers 3. And my very good friend Greg at ILM put up on YouTube an old making of clip that they just happened to have lying around, right? But of course, I see it published that day by Greg, and I think, oh, this must be the new film. I don't have time to really watch it carefully, so I just kind of quickly scan through it, and it's a miniature being distracted. So I go to ILM, interview's going really well. I think I'm like holding my own, and then I say to Scott, so you used miniatures to smash this thing through this, and he just looks at me and goes, that was the first film. And he just looks around the room like going, who is this guy? And I was like, I'm sorry. And then Greg was like in the background going, oh, I just posted that today. And I was just like going red. I'm like, so glad I don't have a camera on me. Because I like pride myself on doing research before interviews. And I was just like, to this day, I don't think I could look Scott in the eye.
That's funny. Well, you guys have had a lot more recognition of, you know, I mean, I've had people stop me after meetings here in L.A., where I've asked a question or something and say, I recognize your voice. You're one of the FX Guide guys. And you guys have certainly had that. You do a lot more on camera than I do.
John seems to get noticed the most, especially on like airplanes and hotels and stuff.
And I've been in a movie theater with a date. And now we love having you come up to us and call so much. You love, because I mean, in all seriousness, first, it is really great to hear from you, because it's like we send them out and we see how many people are watching, and we're really successful in the number of people who listen to it, especially considering the focused nature of the FX podcast. So it's great hearing from that. So please come up and tell us you enjoy it, talk to us. But just if I'm with a date at a movie, no, not so much. That would not be the time to do it. And that's actually now happened twice to me.
Are you the John Montgomery?
Yeah.
Awkward.
Hey, I just want to do two shout-outs if I can. One is I want to thank SohoNet, who's the sponsor of the show this week. It's really great. And I should point out, SohoNet is the company we actually use. So the reason I can do these things from Australia is we have really good bandwidth up and down from dark fiber here in Australia. So big shout-out to Dave and the guys there. They're really terrific. So we're really glad they came on board to help us with this. And the second thing I want to shout-out is just to let you guys know that if you wanted to check it out on FX Guide, Jeff, you have
this. This was one of my favorite classes. When you were up at ILM, I remember you came back and you were all excited, and you were telling me about this, that you got to sit down with some of the guys at ILM and talk to them about the optical printer days. And I thought, well, that's damn cool. I'd watch that just as it is. And then you said, well, but I did more than that. I went to see Stu, our friend Stu Mashwitz, who was at ILM at the time, who actually sat down with those guys when he was working there and said, I want to recreate all this, everything you're doing optically, I want to recreate it in After Effects. So you actually then went and sat down with him and not only saw all that, but then had him show you that in After Effects and gave you the files. And I remember that class when it aired, and now we're making it available on FX Guide. It was part of FX PhD, but now we're putting that on FX Guide, that one class, as a sample. So if you haven't seen FX PhD, I know we talk about it a lot, but if you want to actually check out like what a class feels like, this is a really excellent class and very interesting history lesson about it and kind of talking about that whole optical to digital transition. in a really...
What's cool about background fundamentals is it kind of covers stuff that's current, can cover a variety of sources, but like the 200th, Mike, you gave me a stat today on how many of those you've done at PhD.
Yeah, I've done 250 classes in just background alone.
Yeah.
Well, it's like one of our guests said in the podcast, you know, it's not just enough to be a bunch of smart guys. And I was really struck at IBC, and I mentioned this in a previous podcast, people saying how, you know, they take FX PhD for a class, like let's say they're really into one their particular field, roto, let's say. And then you get multiple classes when you sign up. So they take a class in something like tracking. And it's amazing how many people have told me that they've actually changed an area or changed a different job or even just used that knowledge of tracking to help them in understanding the problems that the tracker's having. Or, you know, to me, it's just all about getting a more rounded exposure as opposed to operating it's very easy to get pigeonholed in tunnel vision.
Yeah, it's true. We love how many people have gone on from PhD to work at the places that we now cover for these major films. Not that we cover the things we do with TV and commercials and stuff, and I take nothing away from those guys because they just do outstanding work. That's what I used to do. But yeah, when you hear of somebody like who's got like on a major feature, and let's face it, we have a lot of them from PhD, it's incredibly rewarding.
I remember about a year in, one of our guys came up to us at a party and said, you know, eventually we're just going to take over because we're going to be, you know, as the years go on, there'll just be more and more of us and we'll just all be in charge.
Actually, I've got to say that's one of the best things about getting older is that all your mates have now elevated to more senior positions in all their respective areas. And so since we've been doing FX Guide, which let's face it, we started FX Guide in like, what, 99? I can never remember if it was 99 or 98. I know
99 is our 99? Earliest one on the Wayback Machine.
Yeah, but I'm sure we were concocting it in 98. But anyway, since then, of course, all our mates, you know, in the last 10, 12 years, whatever that is, have all, you know, gone on to become directors and senior supervisors, and it's just great. But hey, look, can I just do one last thing before we go? I just want to, if we can, dedicate the show, as it were, to our staff, because at the various locations we have around the world, we have studios for doing all this stuff. We just have the most awesome staff that work with us and work for us, and we just couldn't do it without them. And you mentioned Matt at the beginning of the show, but there's a whole team of people in all the offices, and I don't want to go through every single one of them individually, but many of you will know them from interacting with them in the accounts department, FX PhD, or in, you know, getting stuff fixed or
Jimmy Shen,
support,
David
whatever.
Hamm, yeah. Mark Descoli. I'll go through it, you know, because they really do make what you see on FX Side and what you see on FX PhD possible. I mean, obviously, Mike, Jeff, and I are front and center, but
they're the answer to the question. How do you guys do all this?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Ian, who joined the team about a year ago, is just doing outstanding work on FX Guide. I just can't imagine not having him around now. But as you said, you know, there's just a whole lot of people here. The tech guys, the coders, the guys in the Chicago office that do all of the, or most of the coding.
Yeah.
So anyway, we just want to really say a heartfelt thank you to those guys. As much as we owe our existence to you for listening, we also owe it to them for being able to make it actually happen.
Well, thanks again. Thanks to everyone out there who listens, because you guys are why we do this, and we're glad that you really enjoy what we're doing. We really very much appreciate it. It's been a fun ride, to say the least. I'm glad I didn't quit that job. I'm glad I didn't take that job where they wanted me to quit doing FX Guide 15 years ago. So that was a very good decision. I haven't regretted it since. It really is in large part to our viewers and listeners.
Absolutely.
Well, I guess that's it, really, other than to say thanks again. And we've got a whole lot of great stuff coming up on all our other podcasts. Obviously, this one is the probably the longest running, but our FX Guide TV, our VFX show, the RC, all our, and of course, the FX PhD DOD, and at the main site. So please check them out. And thanks again for being so loyal and so supportive.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.